The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This week we're in the portion of Bo, and this is the third in the Getting Out of Egypt or Story of the Exile series, right? Starts with Shemot, which we discussed last week a little bit. The Jewish people, the family of Yaakov, goes down to Egypt. They become enslaved. The whole process of how they become enslaved and what happens goes on to Va'era, which is last week's portion, which is sort of the midst of the plagues and the process of I wouldn't call it the Exodus because they don't get out, but sort of the beginning of seeing the horizon. And then this week, which is the portion of Bo. And although this week begins under somewhat nefarious circumstances, because Moshe is going to Pharaoh, and it almost appears that there's no headway being made, it ends really with the Jewish people about to leave Egypt. So this really covers the gamut of darkness into light. And it's interesting, by the way, just as an aside, that the first word of the portion is a rather strange way to present the dialogue that the portion begins with, because God comes to Moshe and says, Bo el Paro, come to Pharaoh, which is a very strange phrase, and strange on two levels. First of all, it's strange because it implies that God's already there, and he's got to bring Moshe to him. Why would God define himself as being with Pharaoh, right? So let's assume for the moment you could put that aside by suggesting that God is everywhere. So it's less about where God is, it's more about where Moshe is, right? In which case, what it could mean is that the definition of a Moshe, if you're a Moshe, if you're a Jewish leader, then by definition, you're not wherever Pharaoh is. Even if physically you're where Pharaoh is, on a different level, you can't be where Pharaoh is. And this is actually a challenge that we face, I think, in our generation. You know, politics, or what do they say? Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. I have a friend, when we came to Israel, I came to Israel after high school, went to the army, and at one point my brother and I were both considering, you know, whether we should be going into politics, and whether we could make a difference, and a good friend of the family told my brother, you know, just realize that if, and this is somebody who was the director general of the interior ministry here, so he knew what he was talking about. He said, just understand that if you go into politics, you will become dirty. That's the nature of the beast. And on the one hand, it's very saddening to realize that there's a whole system, which is one of the pinnacles of democracy, which by definition has to be corrupt, right? And there's something to be said for the fact that Moshe, that there's a certain level of Jewish leadership that has to be outside that circle. And you could make a case for saying that one of the challenges we find ourselves in today is precisely that we don't have enough, certainly in Israel, of a circle of leadership that's outside that parameter, right? And then, of course, there's the second issue, which is that generally in Judaism, we don't speak about coming, we speak about going, right? The words Bo el Paro, come to Pharaoh, it's very rare that you find the concept of coming. You usually find the concept of going. You know, the first time God speaks to a Jew, Abraham, God says to him, Lech lecha, go. Every Friday night, we begin our Kabbalat Shabbat service with Lechun Ranana, go and sing. Right? The famous song, which is the paradigm of sort of the transmission or the transference from the week into Shabbat, into the moment, is Lecha Dodi. You know, go, my beloved. And that's because in Judaism, you know, we don't believe that the goal is to get there. Right? The goal is to appreciate the journey, to value the struggle. Right? And if you think that you've gotten there, you probably never will get there. As a matter of fact, in Ethics of the Fathers, in Pirkei Avot, it suggests that that when you depart from a person, you should never say to a person, Lech b'shalom, go in peace. You should always say, Lech l'shalom, go towards peace. And in fact, the only time that you ever say to someone, Jewishly, Lech b'shalom, is as you're lowering a coffin into the ground. And then there's a famous sort of part of the service, which is, Lech b'shalom, v'tanuach b'shalom, v'tagil mishkavcha b'shalom. Go in peace and rest in peace, right? But resting in peace is when the journey's over, or at least this journey. So, strange that God would say to Moshe, Bo el Paro, come to Pharaoh. Unless, of course, that is entirely the challenge of Egypt. That whereas we're on a journey, the world of Egypt was all about the here and now. It was all about, we've arrived, and you know, make merry today, for tomorrow we die. Right? Which is a fascinating perspective. That's the beginning of the portion. And this portion really is the essence of, I guess, the beginning, the seeds of redemption. The Jewish people are about to get out of Egypt. We're going to witness the end of the process of the 10 plagues, right? The Jewish nation is being born. And right in the middle of this whole story, at the end of the portion, we find a mitzvah, which is probably one of the stranger mitzvot in the entire Torah. Okay? It says like this. This is in chapter 13, verse 2, Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Bet. Okay? You guys can still hear me, yeah? Okay. Kadesh li kol b'chol, sanctify to me every firstborn, peter kol rechem, the issuance of every womb, b'vnei Yisrael, ba'adam v'abema, right, among the Jewish people, man and beast, right, human being and animal, lihu. It is, it being the Bechor, the firstborn, to me. Right? So, don't get me wrong, there's an interesting idea here. What is this doing in the middle of the story of the Exodus from Egypt? Why here? This is such a strange mitzvah. You know? I know you're getting out of Egypt, and I know that the 10 plagues now are coming to a close. And by the way, this follows the story of the Paschal Lamb. The Jewish people are sitting in their homes. They've placed the blood of the Lamb on the doorpost. God, as it were, himself, whatever that means, is visiting Egypt, about to redeem the Jewish people. The nation is about to be born. And at this point, God takes a moment to tell them, listen, if your cow gives birth, make sure to set aside the first calf. What does this have to do with where we are? It's interesting, by the way, that this mitzvah applies not only to a kosher animal. In fact, the verse takes the time to include even a donkey, which is an impure animal that itself is unkosher. Right? And the Rambam, Maimonides, there's a whole section of law in his magnum opus, the Yad HaZakah, the 14 books of Jewish law, in which he defines the laws of Becharot, of how to do this and what the purpose of it is, and he points out very clearly that when a donkey gives birth, the firstborn donkey is kadosh. It's somehow holy. And that's even stranger. First of all, stranger because whoever heard of a holy donkey, right? And second of all, why is it important here, right? So there are a couple of other questions that are worth mentioning, which maybe will allow us to sort of explore what this is all about. First of all, it's interesting that there's something that seems to be missing from the verse here, okay? It says at the end of the sentence here, at the end of the verse, after I've been told to sanctify every firstborn issuance of animal and man, it says, li hu, it is to me. Now that phrase, li hu, it is to me, right, seems to be missing something. Because it doesn't say what it is to me. Li hu ma, what is it? I would understand if it said kadosh hu li, it's holy to me. I would understand if it said rishon hu li, it's first to me. Why does it say just li hu? It's very strange. Tell you another interesting thing about this mitzvah, which is even stranger. Does anybody know where we find this mitzvah every single day? This particular mitzvah of taking the firstborn of your animal, or by the way, your children, and sanctifying them, setting them aside, right? In fact, what you have to do is, if you're a farmer and you have sheep, so every time your sheep gives birth, you take aside the firstborn, and you literally put it aside, and you have to give it over to the Kohen. You give it to the priest, who can eat it, you know, in the temple or whatever it might be, right? So, where do we find that every day? Fascinating. This is one of the four portions that we write down on a small scroll, sort of a mini version of the scroll of the Torah. We roll it up, and we put it in the tefillin. This mitzvah is inside our tefillin. There are four chapters that are inside the tefillin, and two of them are in this week's portion. The first one is the Shema, right? You know, Hear, O Israel, V'ahavta, and love your God, right? That's the first one, which speaks about the unity of God, that God is one, that God is everywhere, that all things stem from God, that there's not you and me, but there's only us, right? That everything is one. Then the second one is Vayayim Shamar, which is really all about, it's all about, I guess, reward, consequence, you know, the fact that what we do in this world makes a difference, reward and punishment, the concept of mitzvot, and how critical they are, right? That it's not just having the right idea, but doing the right thing in this world. The fourth, which immediately follows this particular mitzvah in this week's portion, is Vayaki V'yachai La'aretz, and it will be when you will come to the land of Israel. The land of Israel is central to the Jewish people, and this is the fourth. Now the other three make sense to me. What on earth is redeeming your firstborn donkey doing in my tefillin? What does that have to do with anything? Right? So maybe in order to understand this, we have to understand two things. We have to understand the nature of beginnings, of birth, and we have to understand the nature of the firstborn. You know, I had such a magnificent experience like a couple weeks ago, which I actually wrote about in the Parsha Byte. We went on this trip down to the desert over Hanukkah, right? And it was just this incredible experience. And, you know, I don't get to do this enough with my kids. I don't know about you guys. And so I was really sort of reveling in every moment of it. In fact, even when we got into the car and we left Efrat and we were just driving down, the drive was such a great experience because it was all ahead of us, you know, just this beginning of a journey, right? And we went down to the desert, and I don't get there that often. My family hasn't been there in years. We went to a place called Machtesh Ramon, which is the Ramon Crater, which is just this incredible, incredible desert area, magnificently beautiful jeep rides, and just incredible. And the last day we were there, before we came back up to Efrat, so there's a sport, which I actually have to look up in the dictionary. We call it snappling. I think you guys call it rappelling. Now, what rappelling is you get on top of a cliff, and you tie yourself into like a harness, you know, like the rope goes kind of under your between your legs, and you wear a helmet, right? And you basically throw yourself off the edge of a cliff and kind of sort of, you know, rappel down. I don't know quite how to describe it. You know, you jump out, and then, you know, like you've seen it in the movies with the SWAT teams, right? You jump out, and then your feet kind of land back on the stone, and then you jump out again, whatever, right? And, you know, we called before. I wanted to make sure that all my kids could do it if they wanted to. It never occurred to me that my little kids would want to do this. You know, I have our eldest, Mayan, so she's like a daredevil. She's like, you know, take me to the highest roller coaster, and is it okay if I go down upside down, right? But, you know, the other kids, they're on different levels. All four of them decided they had to do this. We were with another family. We were with friends. You know, if the friends do it, you have to do it. And there's this moment, okay? You would think that the hardest part of this experience is when you're actually out there over the cliff and going down. It's not true. Once you're going down, that's easy. It's amazing. When you stand at the top, okay, you're on the edge of the cliff, you hold the rope, and then the instructor tells you to lean back. You have to lean all the way back. It seems completely unnatural. You're not just leaning back. You're leaning over this cliff, which is God knows how many hundreds of feet down to the desert floor below. You just can't imagine. This is an insane thing to do. And I went down, and I was down below, sort of, you know, before the kids. I was waiting for the kids to come down. I wanted to take pictures of them from the bottom. So I'm looking up, and I'm seeing the face on each of my children, right? Especially Yonatan, who's the bar mitzvah boy, and Yair, who's the youngest, who's seven, who insisted on doing this. And there's this moment of, like, sheer terror. And I'm just thinking, like, what did I get my kids into, right? And, of course, at the end, they all did it, so it was incredible because it's self-esteem, and it makes them feel great, and, you know, whatever, fine. And you wonder, why is that beginning, why is that moment of beginning so challenging, right? You would think that it's much harder to be in the middle, because at that moment of beginning, you can still turn around. You can decide not to do it, and they'll just say, fine, I'll give you a hand, and you'll get back up, and you'll take off the harness. Once you're down over the cliff, you know, you're stuck, you're out in the air. But that's not as scary. And I was thinking about this, and I wonder if maybe it's because in that moment of beginning, everything is before you. So you have nothing to base your experience on. You have nothing to rely on. It's a very lonely moment. It's completely ahead of you, right? In fact, it's interesting that that really is the challenge of the firstborn. You know, think about this. Who is the first firstborn? Think about it. Who's the first firstborn? in the Torah, in history. Right, Cain, right? Now some people might say Adam, but Adam wasn't born, right? Adam was created. So he never had that process of pure, raw beginning, of everything lying ahead. And in fact, there's an interesting debate among the rabbis, since he was created as an adult, if that's how we accept it, right? Was he also created with history? You know? Like, was he created knowing how to speak? Or did he also have to learn how to speak, but it was accelerated? So that's a whole interesting discussion. His son, Cain, firstborn, is the first one who has to learn everything from scratch. Right? He has nothing to rely on. And it's not no accident that the firstborn and beginnings in general are very challenging in Judaism. Right? Adam as a beginning messes up. Adam has the first mitzvah, messes it up. Cain as a beginning messes that up. Doesn't know how to deal with a brother because he's never had the experience. Right? Right? The next beginning you have is Noah. That's also a mess. It's only when you get to Abraham that beginning, because it now has a number of beginnings to rely on, takes a different energy. In fact, there's a halacha, there's a tradition, that the firstborn gets a double portion. Right? In other words, if I have three boys, let's say, or three kids, and my eldest, you know, he has his challenges, let's say, he would get, if he was firstborn, he would get a double portion. Now the reason he gets a double portion is because he has to put up with twice the stuff. And we know this from experience. I mean, I don't know about you guys. I know Norman and I were once talking about this. You know, we were blessed because our eldest, you know, we just have to get out of the way, right? But being the eldest, even with that notwithstanding, is a very hard thing. You know? Nobody else is forging the path. You have much more responsibility than the other kids, right? Even though it has its advantages. So because of those struggles and because of those challenges, I mean, you know, God willing, Bezrat Hashem, you know, I don't know, all sorts of beginnings lie ahead of our eldest, right? Mayan. She'll have her first date. She doesn't have anybody in the family to talk to about her first date because her brother's younger than her. She'll have her first experience in the army or national service, wherever she goes. She won't be able to talk to one of her siblings about it because they haven't done it yet. And there's something about that beginning which is very challenging. And it's a little bit frightening. In fact, it's interesting that if you look at the mitzvah of tefillin, Rav Cook points out, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, who was the first chief rabbi of Israel before there was a state. So he has a magnificent commentary on the whole prayer book, the whole Siddur. And in discussing the blessing of tefillin, he says a fascinating thing that I never noticed before. When you put tefillin on in the morning, the blessing that you say, right, is lehaniach tefillin, to place tefillin on my arm. Now that's not actually the mitzvah. In fact, if you look carefully in this week's portion, you'll see that it says ukshartem, and you shall tie them for a sign on your hands and an adornment between your eyes. And the mitzvah is really to tie them. In fact, when you put the tefillin on your arm, the reason you put the tefillin on your arm is because now you're ready to tie it. You make the blessing, because we make a blessing before the mitzvah, just like I make a blessing over bread before I eat it, etc., right? So that the blessing almost gives me permission, a certain level of recognition, that I understand what this mitzvah is about, right? So the mitzvah really is to tie the tefillin to my arm. In fact, if I put the tefillin on my arm for a second, and I make a blessing, Anos, Dominos, Sanctimos, whatever I say, and then I take it off, I haven't fulfilled the mitzvah because I didn't tie it onto my arm. So really the blessing should be Al mitzvat kshirat tefillin. It should be on the mitzvah of tying the tefillin. And by the way, that fits mystically with the whole message of tefillin. The whole message of tefillin is that we make a decision, right? Do we really bind ourselves to this way of life? Does this really become a part of us? Are we willing to limit ourselves to a certain degree? Because what happens when you put on tefillin? You're limiting yourself. You're tying yourself in. And many people have tremendous difficulty with that because, you know, we live in a world that says that freedom is a value, and the freer you are, the more you can accomplish. And if we limit ourselves, and yet that's not really true. In the real world, when you really stop to think about it, it's only when we limit ourselves that we can achieve our greatest potential, right? It's like when you get married. So when you get married, you've made a decision to limit yourself to one person. But it's precisely because you limit yourself to that one person that you can discover unlimitedness with them. right? If you don't limit yourself to one person and you're with a different woman every day, so you may be with all of them, but you're not really with any of them because you're trying to be with all of them. When you limit yourself to one person, you can discover unlimitedness with that one person. And it's the same with anything in life. You meet people who bop around from business idea to business idea, from job to job. They're not here, they're not there, they're not really anywhere. And then you get a person who dedicates themselves to one idea and one goal, and because they've limited themselves to that focus, to that goal, to that idea, they can create unlimited potential with that idea. So that's part of the idea of putting tefillin on. I limit myself in order to bind myself and discover unlimitedness. So the blessing should say, al kshirat tefillin, to tie to. So why does it say lahaniach, to place tefillin? So Rav Kook says such a beautiful thing. He says, because when you put the tefillin on your arm, there's a moment. It's a moment of pure, raw beginning, of pure potential. You haven't even bound the tefillin on yet. It's all ahead of you. And that moment allows you to sanctify the future. It allows you to suggest that what I'm about to do and everything that I'm about to do, my journey, right, has a purpose. So I take a moment to ask myself, well, what really is that purpose? What's this all for? Do I choose to dedicate this to good? You know, it's not only about what I do, it's about why I choose to do it. Beginnings allow me to determine, to define, to struggle with, to elevate purpose. And that's why there's a certain sanctity, there's a certain power, there's a certain beauty, a certain holiness in the beginning of beginnings. And that's why we say la'aniach tefillin. As soon as I place that tefillin on my arm, which, by the way, I do at the beginning of my day, not accidentally, right? What I'm choosing to do is to sanctify that moment and to ask myself, to give pause, so what is this day going to be? What is this beginning about? Why am I doing this? Where is this going? And I wonder if maybe that's the idea of this mitzvah, you know? By setting aside the firstborn, and by the way, not just of animals, but of our children. There's a whole ceremony that we do. We take a firstborn baby boy. Like, I've never fulfilled either of these mitzvot. I'm not a shepherd, so I've never had a firstborn calf or donkey. And it happens to be our eldest is a girl, so we didn't fulfill that mitzvah with a boy. And why, by the way, there's a difference between a boy and a girl has to do with the fact that this is sort of related to the fact that that boy can one day serve in the temple. And eventually, by the way, the firstborns lose their sanctity because they participate in the sin of the golden calf. And so the tribe of Levi, which didn't participate in them, takes their place. And that's why to this day there's a custom that you take the firstborn baby boy to a Kohen and you redeem that baby. As if to say, this firstborn should have been holy like a Kohen. He's not for reasons of history. But we take a moment to appreciate that process. Right? And I'll tell you two more things and then I'll just open up the floor or the airwaves to anybody who has a question. One, which is fascinating to me, is that now it starts to make sense to me what this mitzvah is doing here. In other words, I understand what it's doing in the tefillin, because that's the whole message of tefillin, but I even understand why this mitzvah is here just as they're about to leave Egypt. Because what we're about to witness at the end of this portion is the birth of a nation. Until now, this people has been a family, but now they become a nation. In fact, it's interesting, this mitzvah is related to the next portion of those four portions that go into the tefillin, v'hayaki yivyachai la'aretz, and it will be when God brings you into the land. And the commentaries point out, why doesn't it say in this mitzvah, ki tavo el aretz, when you will come to the land, fulfill this mitzvah? That would make sense, right? Set aside the firstborn for service in the temple. That only makes sense in Israel, because there's no temple outside of Israel. So the commentaries explain, no, this mitzvah applied even in the desert. This mitzvah applies anywhere. We fulfill this mitzvah in New York, in Chicago, anywhere. So then, of course, that leaves the question, well, why? Right? And why is it juxtaposed to the next of the four portions in the tefillin, which is when you will come to the land? So there are two ideas. One idea is that this mitzvah is the mitzvah whose merit will bring you into the land. Because of this mitzvah, you will merit to enter the land of Israel. So that's like strange. What does this have to do with entering the land of Israel? Except, of course, if this mitzvah is all about appreciating the beginning of our birth of a nation, in order to really be a nation, we have to have a land. That's what defines a nation, that we have a place to call our own, right? And entering that place and having the right to be in that place is all about sanctifying beginnings and whether or not we appreciate why we do what we do to what purpose we want to be a nation. There's no point to being a nation if that nation is not going to make the world better. And there's no point to our birth as individuals if we're not going to try to make the world better. And in the purity of the beginning, we take a moment to consider where we're going and exactly why we want to get there. Which leads me to the last point. It's not accidental that this mitzvah is anywhere. Because this idea is not limited to time and space. This mitzvah is about who we are. It's not about where we live. It's not about what we do. It's about who we are. Wherever we are, as Jews, do we appreciate the enormous potential of every given moment, in every given day, at every given time? You know? And Dafka, and this specifically in this week's portion, sort of that power of beginnings as we're about to be born as a nation. And I'll end by saying, you know, we're living in a generation of the sanctity of the firstborn, because after 2,000 years, we are witnessing really the beginning of an entire new era for the Jewish people. 50 years ago, there was no such thing as a state of Israel. You know, the idea of a Jewish army, the idea that we can create peace, you know, and maybe that is part of our challenge today, to figure out how we can get back to basics, how we can begin to consider what the journey is about, and how to make that journey a little holier, a little better, a little purer, and make sure that we don't forget the raison d'être, the reason for our being here in the first place.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.